This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to
Peter Seeberg. Good morning, Robert. Good morning, afternoon, evening to you, dear podcast listener. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Peter. I am responsible for the main part today. I did an interview on self-learning systems in medtech. It's about brooms, brushes, and the ramp up of machines. Very exciting. But what do you have in the news part, Peter?
What happened? I guess close to what we've been doing originally, Siemens buys Altair Engineering, as Siemens is our current podcast partner. Nevertheless, I did want to represent it, but let me therefore just quote an analyst. You know, let's not get into you or I saying this is good or not good. Let's quote Chantal Bolsonetti. She's from ARC. And actually, there were many, many people. I'm going to go into it a little bit as well later on. She says the addition of Altair highly complementary simulation portfolio with strengths in mechanical, electromechanical capabilities, enhances Siemens' digital twin, full-suite physics-based simulation. We'll get to that in a moment. She talks about how Altair allows anyone, engineers, generalists, to access simulation expertise, and is going to complement Siemens' industrial domain expertise, product lifecycle, manufacturing processes. Now, there's a lot of discussion that I saw last week on LinkedIn, I guess elsewhere as well, about the role of smaller companies, startups, then acquisitions in this. Well, there's a combination of computer-aided engineering, PLM, EDA, the market I was in, very short time, Mentor Graphics, that was bought a couple of years back here, actually, by Siemens. So there was a lot of discussion. They say now there's a handful of big companies. So next to Siemens, there's Dassault, Synopsys, Cadence in this EDA market that I recall from my short time, Autodesk as well. And the discussion is about what is that going to do to, you know, is there room for new developments? And I'll come to at least one new development that I see there. So that's what's happening there. And then the discussion around confirming this, which is a $10 billion acquisition, confirming the value of simulation, right? Basically, so these kind of huge numbers didn't happen, not specifically in the industrial, let's say the hardware space. It has been taking place, of course, in the software space. But let's stop it at that moment. But and closing off, there is zero discussion. And I added somewhere in one of these discussions a question. I said, you know, what role is AI for simulation going to play? And I looked this morning and nobody reacted to it, which is very untypical. But of course, one person in his own, that is Johannes Brandstetter, chief researcher at NXAI, on exactly the very topic of simulation. He had a separate one, and he took one of those threads, and he added on top, and he said, so much opportunities for disruption in this space, ... And that's where he left it. And that's where I guess we can talk about it a little bit.
I'm not allowed to talk about that.
No, you're not allowed to talk about that. Yeah, that's okay. But it was very interesting, sure. And so this, you could say it's a typical, untypical. I have not been following that specific. I think there was another quote of, you know, there's hundreds of people, thousands of people who follow all these acquisitions. I think it was suggesting that Siemens had now been doing like a total of 20 billion, I guess. I mean, it was referring back to the 18. Is it 1840? Is it 1880s? 140, 150-year-old company. So I do not know all those details. From that perspective, it is a huge acquisition, but in the normal sense. But again, what does that mean to if at some point in time, you know, AI is going to change things? So what can we say more at the moment?
It's a wise decision, I think.
Yeah,
by the Siemens management.
Yeah, most certainly. And nevertheless, stay close and we keep you updated on the side of what AI is going to be doing too. We have discussed this a couple of times here, and I'm most certainly convinced that any of these major players are very much aware, very much working on including AI in their solutions. Let's see what that's going to be doing to any of their offerings.
So I have a small cliffhanger, I would call it, because recording on Monday, you will hear the episode on Thursday, and we will publish something tomorrow, which is very interesting, and it goes directly in this direction.
Oh, that's a cliffhanger.
That's a cliffhanger, yeah.
Okay.
So follow us, follow me, you will see it then. It's quite impressive what they did.
I wasn't aware you were going to say this. So when I said, stay close, we'll keep you updated, that's what we'll do within the next couple of days already.
Okay. Exactly. It's on Friday. I have some news from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
My boss, Sepp Hochreiter, will give the keynote address on Wednesday. This is a great honor, and we are all very happy. And the interesting part is also that the conference is bursting at the seams. It's amazing. It's amazing. So much registration, so much people want to come to Neurips. I think it's peak AI, really. They started now a lottery for registration because there are too many people. The conference center is too small to handle all the people. It's amazing. Wow.
Is it going to be Las Vegas therefore next year? Or
no, it's in Vancouver this year. Maybe next year Las Vegas. I'm not sure, but
yeah.
It's huge. Hotel prices. There's no space for the people. And yeah, crazy. And now starting a lottery.
Yeah, sounds like Munich Oktoberfest talking about a lottery. That's just one example, of course. I mean, there's hundreds of examples like these. But there was one, and it's really completely unimportant which one it is. But there was exactly this topic on the discussion of, you know, why is Las Vegas, why are all these huge? Because it was a radio station asking these completely unimportant questions. It's rather funny sometimes, but normally I do not. But in this case, it was. And then I think they were asking how many cities were they asking have a capacity of more than, and then you needed to guess the number. Hotels with more than, I don't know, let's say 5,000 rooms. And then, of course, came out Las Vegas is, of course, the very big number one there. So let's see if this is really what is happening today, then I guess there's a big chance they're going to be doing it in Las Vegas next year.
Oh, yeah. I think the whole organizing team is under stress. And yeah, I don't want to change my roles with them. So good luck for this conference. It will be huge, right?
But very much looking forward to. I was at the beginning, as you recall, I was considering going flying as well. But I've been too late, I guess, already now. But
you are not part of the lottery now, yeah?
Very much looking forward to. I'm not sure. Do you think we're going to be able to listen to Sepp talking live as well?
Yeah, you can register online to the conference and then you can follow the live stream, I think, yeah.
Okay, maybe you want to add that in the podcast note as well, yeah. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it. And then looking forward to what you're going to be bringing back, maybe what you can be doing, pieces live recordings with specific, one of the 20,000 papers that have been accepted of the 100,000 that were handed in, I guess.
In a moment, we produce videos for our paper sessions. And I was not aware of that because you only present your paper, but then you have also to record a video before because they show the videos then in their online conference. And so in a moment, we produce a lot of videos and we produce our papers. Then we produce the poster sessions. And so it's quite busy days in the moment.
So very similar to what you did for Max, who's going to be doing the keynote next week, machine learning week here in Munich, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But they have to record it really 5 minutes and you have to present your research in 5 minutes. And that's a tough one, right? Present your research in 5 minutes. That's tough, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's what I recall is the, how did we mention that? Is the, you know, you get into the elevator, you have
elevator pitch, yeah, exactly.
is the elevator pitch difficult? And the elevator pitch, depending on where you're based, you know, if you're based in New York, maybe Frankfurt, maybe Chicago, or let's say Saudi Arabia, somewhere, Singapore, maybe you're lucky, you have 1 minute, you have actually 1 minute, but in most places, you have actually 5 seconds, right? Oh, Mr. CEO, I am Peter, I'm a podcast, oh, what am I? Sorry, I forgot what I am. Bye-bye. Good.
Yeah. What else do you have, Peter?
Agents, what more?
Agents.
Oh. One of the many, well, of course, everything is about agents, but that's exactly why I do want to just quickly talk about it, just once more. There was an article from Han Lee, but there's many other ones as well. There's a Cobus. There's a Cobus Greiling. He just pops up in my mind right now. There's another guy. It's almost you must follow when you're interested in agents. But this Han Lee on GitHub, I believe, hype and reality. And that's what I quickly want to talk about it. Because elsewhere there was this, oh, yeah, there's another. I think it was a Microsoft guy, somebody else again, agents. And, oh, there's another hype, as we say, another animal being forced through town. Another, the new hype of, he says, what's an agent? What's intelligence? And that's what I always ask when somebody asks me about, Peter, what is artificial intelligence? First question is, what is normal intelligence? We do not really know. We know, but we cannot easily. Now, he says an agent is essentially a software entity, acts on behalf of a user to perform tasks autonomously. Like BPA, we heard it last week, business process automation is the old one, robotic process automation, RPA, and Dan Christian Gill here last week in the postcard, he added then the new acronym, very much in line with what I'm saying here, APA, agentic process automation. So Han says the workflow aspect of the agent is not new. You know, it existed for 30 years. There's a paper from Franklin, 96. I downloaded it this morning. I couldn't read it yet, but it's about taxonomy. So the title is it an agent or just a program? A taxonomy for autonomous agents. We can link that maybe as well. I'm going to be reading it sometime later. And what is important, I believe, is that what is, of course, new and why everybody is doing agents. And it's always like what a hype is, you know, the famous hype cycle from Gartner. I'm not actually using it, but I still think it's the best, one of the best, what should I say, visualizations of technology since probably 30 years. There's always this negative side of the hype, but if you come out of the trough, and I believe most of us are convinced that at least with artificial intelligence, there are so many elements, LLM, etc., but also the agents, I'm confirmed, will come out of the trough and will be all helping us. And what is new is that instead of what before, so 30 years ago and then 20 years ago, we had these rule-based systems, and Christian was saying that as well. Today, we're deploying large language models, and we're simulating intelligence. You know, we're acting in a behavior in a flexible way. So, and then my personal maybe future, what is intelligence? Well, what is artificial intelligence? What is human intelligence? I'm then going to say, well, what is an agent? I would say it is my personal assistant, you know, that we're going to get as a personal travel agent booking my flight instead of me 30 years ago. And some, mainly all the people, I would say, still doing so today, right? Going into the travel office. We still have one here a couple of hundred meters back. It's a very small one person sitting there. And they sit in front of and interact with the travel agent. That is where the English term comes from. Or, you know, you and I don't know, when did we start booking our flights on the internet? Maybe 20 years, maybe 10 years. So, and that is the development where I am really convinced that these agents at the moment still very, let's say, as they step by step, typically doing smaller things, but very soon, you know, the agent by itself saying, oh, I see what we just talked about. You know, you're going to be going to the conference in Vancouver. I already booked you a flight because I assume it's going to be very, very busy. you know, the agent is going to be ahead of you. And then a month later, you're going to say, oh, I'm so busy. I'm so happy that my personal agent already booked me a flight.
But who has the best agent then? You need to have the best agent because you have to be the best trained agent, right? The most intelligent agent, yeah?
Yeah, most certainly. I have this overview here, which is only part of the answer, of course. And again, in sharing with you, dear listener, this idea of the travel agents, you know, we're not a travel podcast. I believe you do get the point, understand the point. If that is what can happen, what will be happening in the area of, in this case, travel agent, then what does that mean for your business, for our business in an industrial space? What is the best? I don't know if you were asking this with a specific idea on knowing which is the best. Sure, there's hundreds of solutions. Well, we'll come to one here. Let's start with Philip Schmidt here, you know, technical lead at Hugging Face. And as we said before, I think there's 1 million language models on Hugging Face. So are we soon going to have a million agents? Yeah, it could very well be. Why not? I think it is going to be exactly that. Now, for those of you that are more the developers, so this is not for me, this is also not for you, who Robert and I, we're not both developers, but still, he's asking, which agentic framework do you use to build? And then why do I share it? Because, you know, if a guy like Philip and a company like Hugging Face, you know, is asking that question, they are not asking it because they think it's a negative hype and we can ask him, but nevertheless, so he gives 3-4 options. And when I did it yesterday, what was the Langchain, Langgraph, 50% of the answers until I had given the answer. I think there was a couple of thousand at that time. There's Llama Index Workflow and there's Crew AI. They were 10%, 12% and custom were 28%, so a quarter. And out of custom, I went through the discussion. Those of you, again, developing, are you considering, again, we'll look at Philip Schmidt, you should be following him anyway if you're doing something with large language models. And then you see other names of other agentic frameworks like AutoGen. That was mentioned most often. People said it should have already been in at the beginning. Swarm, TXT, AI, PhiData, and then two more. Multi-agent, Orchestrator, Letta, DiFi. I'll stop there. The other ones you can see. So these are only about frameworks. Now, these frameworks are going to be helping you, the developers, to build these wonderful agents that then Robert and I and all the other listeners that are not developers themselves will be using, not only for doing our travel bookings, but for, let's see.
I recall the episode with Rainer Brehm about agent at Siemens, because then we had a discussion, do we need new standards when it comes to agents? And he said, I don't know. So there's an undiscovered terrain in the industrial sector also when it comes to agents. Yeah.
Could be, because all these digital developments, which they are in the end, I mean, you and I a couple of years earlier than you, but where we started was in what was called IT automation, I guess, right? And we've been seeing all these developments, latest of which we've been doing now for almost 6 years, industrial AI. And now we get agents, and then we had large language models, now we have agents. And with all these developments on a higher level, everything is growing together, but this growing together, and that's, I believe, where the question maybe from you is coming from and where the answer is not yet available. There's always many options, but it is like in relation to when I say that all of us are going to have our personal assistant on our smartphone, which is what I'm convinced of for the next couple of years, at least. Yes, how is this, let's say, smartphone, maybe the device is going to change, but it must be somewhere around me, right? I mean, it can be my screen on my notebook, whatever it is, but I think the personal assistant, at least on my smartphone when I'm traveling, and that will need to interact with the rest of the world, right? With its own sensors, of course, as we know today, whatever is there. How do we call them? Forget the English word here. So we smell and we see and we hear the senses. Senses, right. We have how many? 5 or 6. And then we have GPS and all the other things that are already in there. But then there need to be other ways of interacting with all these other agents. As I suggested, I come to this machine. Let's go back to the quote by Zapp. Zapp says, you know, I asked the machine how it's doing, and then machine says, so how is that interaction working? That's an easy one, right? But that's only one example. And in the future, I probably, when I'm responsible, I walk into the factory and the systems know that at that time that I walk in, that I am in charge. And there's going to be some way of interacting with my personal assistant. And my personal assistant will just tell me immediately, or maybe even in the car or in whatever way I get to the factory, that, you know, production system XYZ has a problem. So that's probably the first thing I should be looking at. It's not because I asked, but because of my assistant. And how these all these things will communicate, yeah, let's see.
Perfect. What else do you have, Peter?
Oh, politics, but not politics. Politics. We don't talk politics. Trump and AI. So in this case, we sometimes misspell when we talk about the German... No, I'm not even going to talk it because I don't want to relate the two together. So the US people have voted. Trump is going to be the new, again, president. And I only want to quickly talk about what does that probably mean as far as artificial intelligence, as far as AI, as far as industrial AI is concerned, and for AI in general, in the United States, in Europe, in the world. Well, all I'm going to share is, as far as I've seen, Trump is known to be very anti-regulation, right? That's all I really want to... somebody else is going to say that is not correct, and that's fine, that is so, but I've seen so many reports and quotes that is the case, right? So without going into details again, no politics, I guess it's fair to expect that we in Europe have been known and we continue to confirm to be the global regulator, you know, without saying good or bad. The US has been known for in general and will now more strongly again confirm their anti-regulation. There was this one point where, who is he? Is he the senator? Is that the right word? No, the governor of all these political, the governor of California 2-3 weeks ago, right?
Newsom.
Right. Very good. And if he would have cited it to go for a specific law, that would have confirmed that, you know, California many times from a regulation perspective is similar to Europe, as is many times Canada, I believe, as well, right? Now, already that was a sign, maybe I should say already, but that was a sign, because I don't want to make links that maybe do not exist. I do not know them. But at that time, he was not going to sign that law. So that was also, let's say, some kind of anti-regulation, again, without me saying good about. So what does it mean in the end? I think the US will be the place where big tech will be on the forefront of AI.
Exactly.
Nothing new. Hey, right? Oh, Peter, what are you saying? That's completely new. No, it's not, but it's going to be even stronger, right, with Europe keeping its citizens protected from AI through regulation. I'm not saying, again...
Protected in quotation marks, right?
Exactly. You know, we can quickly chat about it if we want to. And then China, let's say China, and then, of course, all the other countries, but I don't talk about it. And China, I would say, probably doing both. They do allow for, stimulate the latest, greatest AI, but in combination with... you know, even more powerfully controlling its citizens through its social scoring system.
Yeah, heavy times. No limits for AI in the USA, I think, with Elon Musk too. Jeff Bezos, they both will get in touch with Donald Trump. They work together. They supported each other. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, but we can say it's more confirming it's even more clearer. It's almost like if you go for a typical machine learning classification where you say, oh, now the data shows that there's an overlap here and there. Now, this is a classification which is very easy. You know, you see the red dots on the left and you see the green bullets on the right. And I would say there is, as far as AI regulation is concerned, the overlap is minimal. Maybe it was there, as I suggested, as I believe it was. I'm not a specialist in this area, but I believe it's going to be very clear that there's going to be two completely different markets there, right?
But we can complain all we like, but what can we do about it now, Peter?
Oh, yeah, I don't even complain about it. It was more like, because many times when people do want to discuss politics with me also privately, right. I always typically like to go up to the meta level. I say, oh, let's not discuss politics. It's so boring. And depending on where you are. I mean, when I was 10 years in the United States,
I think the next 4 years won't be boring.
No, but when I was 10 years in the United States, Intel, that's not what you would do. At that time, it was sometimes even possible. But you just don't discuss politics in, you know, person A is good or person B. Oh, no, let's fight about it. These discussions I don't typically do. What can we do? We just do our thing. And anyway, you know, since we changed when 2-3 years back from doing our podcast in German language at that time, we were kind of limited to the German speaking market, moved to English. We are for all you listeners from wherever you are in the world. And that's why also we don't want to talk politics, because, you know, that's not what we're about.
You mentioned Intel. That's a good keyword. What happened, Peter? What happened to Intel? Now, the end of the Dow Jones Industrial Index, NVIDIA will take over the place. What about your old Intel stories, Peter?
I had only a short moment, but I did almost let a tear leave my eye when I saw that. It's just when we were there in the 90s, yeah, you know, we all together, we made this company the number one market capitalization. That's amazing, which is today, I don't know, Is it Apple? Is it NVIDIA? One of those? Whatever. So we were in the time in the 90s or later, there were still a couple of other huge, you know, there was Petrol, and there were some huge retail. And I think Intel was the first one kind of in the IT, in the semiconductor in this case. So it's sad to see. We still have high hopes in Pat Gelsinger, but it feels like their problems are relatively so big. At the same time, you know, what company stays there for 20, 30, 40 years? Microsoft, maybe. I must say that they've been there for a very long time. But we were already told at that time by Andy Grove, only the paranoid survive, and maybe the people after us were not, maybe at least, but I need to be careful here as well. I do not have too many friends that still now even work there, I guess, and I haven't been too close to them. So I don't want to suggest that people who stayed there or the new companies they bought, that's, and then maybe we come back to the beginning. Buying companies is always a very special, risky thing to do as well. This is not my consulting quote on Siemens buying Altair, but it is a thing that you must be aware of. You need to integrate technology and you need to integrate the people. And Intel had a very, very special culture in the 90s. And then when you start buying companies, it's not always easy to integrate them and have them be thinking like you do.
Do you still have something for the news part?
Yeah, final one. In AI, we don't trust is a quote by brand research company, or is a brand research Lippincott. At least they did a brand research. Interestingly, that's what I kind of was strongly involved in at Intel as well at the time. The majority of consumers, they don't trust brands, is what they say when it comes to artificial intelligence. They have 46% of the people trust a brand less if they learned that it was using AI to provide services, which they assumed were coming from a human. That's one very important point. Now, that's, of course, what we talked about a long time. I wrote about it in the book and said, that's why we need this. Interesting, you asked for Intel this time, Intel Inside. I've always been saying we need this AI inside. You need to put this label up and say, this machine in front of you, this whatever it is using AI. And then you come back to the brand. I'm not going to suggest what it is that we need to do. But at that time, the Intel Inside brand was at a value of, 10% plus being a processor with an Intel Inside in your notebook or without. And that was an amazing value, as you can imagine. Now, number two, and we come back to what we just said. Additionally, despite the hype around AI, only 7% of consumers are willing to pay more for AI features.
Well,
you just said. And in fact, 57% expect to pay the same price as they would for non-AI products. Well, and you discussed it, as you just said.
There's a lot to do.
That's exactly my finishing word as well. There's a lot of work ahead for all of us, explaining the added value of our AI solutions to our customers.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point, because let's talk now about a nice AI use case, a self-learning yeah. system in the ramp-up process.
Okay.
And it reduced the ramp-up process time up to 20% or something. So there's a real benefit for the company. I recorded a very nice episode with two guys in the medtech industry. Peter, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, still one question on that. So are you asking him or her if they can therefore get a higher price? Or is it more like they come to the market with a solution, which is, what did you say, 20% faster?
Faster, 20%.
And because it's 20% faster, and let's say...
in the ramp-up process, yeah.
Let's say all other things equal, they are going to have a huge potential for companies to buy it. And so maybe that's already, just as a final thought, and is it AI is helping us to move ahead, to be more effective, more efficient, and therefore the customer is going to save cost, and therefore they're going to buy our products. And if we don't, then we're not going to be bought anymore. Maybe that's only one. But a topic that we should be talking about next time as well. Robert, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today, we talk about brooms, brushes, medtech market, and AI in a highly regulated environment. My guests are Felix Müller from Plus10. Hello, Felix. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, everybody.
And Timo Steinebrunner from Zauransky. Welcome, Timo.
Hey, folks. Hello, Robert.
Felix, before we start, please introduce yourself briefly to the listeners.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I'm Felix. I'm one of the three founders of Plus10. We are actually a research spin-off from Fraunhofer, European largest applied research organization. And my background is data science and production technology. And I'm always very keen on developing new technologies that really brings a value add for society and business.
New technology is the key word here. Yeah, we are looking forward to this episode. Timo, please introduce yourself briefly.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity, Robert. So my name is Timo Steinebrunner. I'm the head of global sales here at Zauransky. My focus is on medtech, but I speak for the group itself today. And we are very well known and one of the market leaders for the prosthetic care, oral care business. And today we are also serving the healthcare medtech market with innovative and sophisticated production lines.
But brooms and brushes was right? Or am I wrong?
Absolutely. So we are manufacturing machines for brooms and brushes, and also machines especially for healthcare solutions, just as toothbrushes and interdental brushes.
Can you please explain us a bit your business model? What industry do you work in? What is special about these industries? And what was your problem, your pain, or your customer pain, and why?
Yes, sure. We are working for different branches. So the Zauransky Group have different products in their portfolio. So we serve either machines and production lines for brooms and brushes. And earlier they have been more manual, but today they are more and more automated. The same we have for oral care. So that means the times where a lot of operators are working in the shop floors are over. So more and more automation arrives in the shop floors and in the factories. And also the products became more complex. and complicated. And as the production need to be efficient and even more efficient, it means that we have made lines which are hosting molding processes, tufting processes, packaging processes, and all is inline. And that makes the lines rather complex. And the same for MedTech, by the way. So we have an expertise, especially for primary packaging, such as syringes out of COC, where we build lines from the granule, from the molding process up to a tub, which is ready to sterilize.
Mm-hmm. What was your pain and why?
The pain we have experienced was first in-house. So as we are combining different items, different technologies, which means, okay, there is not only a mold anymore, there is a mold combined with automation, or in the dental brush business, there are a wiring brush making machine for the tiny in the dental brush. This is then transferred to a molding and assembly cell, and you have cameras, you have ball feeders, you have a final packaging of the product, and all these items are combined together, and then everything gets more complex, also from a software, from a programming point of view, especially for us, once everything brought together in the sense of ramp up and keeping the overview by ourselves. And later on also at the customer. So also the customer had a pain because he need to run the line. He need to run a more complex line, and he needs to have even more skilled operators, which is also not all the time given today.
So the keyword is ramp up, reduce complexity.
Absolutely. Ramp up and reducing complexity, or make complexity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to AI? Did you do a POC? How did the idea come about?
Yeah, I think the idea was formed 3-4 years ago, and we were looking for solutions which makes the things less complex and helping not only ramp up.
What is so complex? Can you explain? Is it to combine all these modules, or are the machines too complex, or is it the software too complex?
I think it's the combination of all the different modules, and yeah, keeping the overview and maintaining the complexity also from the programming software point of view. And even if there is later on, first of all, you have the ramp up, you need to investigate if there is a failure, where the failure comes from, how to solve, and what is the corrective action. And even the customer, once he is running the line, he has the same challenges.
So once again, how did you come to AI? I interrupt you, sorry for that.
Yeah, that's fine. I guess, Felix, you can support me a little bit on that, because I joined Ransky recently. But what I understood is that it was mainly from the history, in just to handle the complexity and the ramp up, to keep the overview and speed up with the ramp up times.
Felix, help Timo a bit.
I can just add, I mean, I think the main beginning or starting point of our collaboration was that we helped out in a very technical, or let's say specific, problem where one very huge production line, which was full of new technologies, so processes that never were experienced before, all freshly developed. So basically put up a production line that has never been produced before, and we tried to ramp it up. And at some point, all technicians came to the conclusion, apparently, that the current complexity is too high, or let's say, you don't have enough time to solve everything manually, basically, or the problems and interactions. So which process is influencing the neighbor processes, and how, and in what quantitative sense. And therefore, basically, they started to research a bit and found out about our Plus 10 technology, our research spin-off Plus 10. I think it's 4 years ago now. So we were pretty fresh on the market after our 5 years of research and developing prototypes internally at Fraunhofer. Yeah, and basically the idea about using AI is in that very special sense pretty helpful because you can classify and you can learn behavior models on live data. So you don't have to wait until you collected some data, you train a model on it, and that's it. But we do it rather the other way around. We continuously learn models. So we never stop learning and learn basically the health score, how does processes behave, and characterize them by the live data, and never stop characterizing them, because the process will behave different in day one and in day 100 and day 1000.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through the process, Felix. The machine arrives at the customer's factory or shop floor. What happens then?
Oh, you would even start earlier. You would start just before the production line leaves the factory of Zawanski or the machine builder. So basically, when the line is ready to run, so it's physically set up, so it's, let's say, potentially able to produce parts, you can start installing our software and configuring it. So basically, it starts listening to all the machine controllers that are integrated in that line. And we are interpreting the PLC projects and the live data to find out who's disturbing who and who's basically the root cause of a problem and who is just the consequence of a root cause.
How do you do that? Is it a software tool? Is it an application?
It's a software tool which is basically listening to all controllers in parallel in a high frequency. So all the variables that are changing in milliseconds on the controller level are observed to learn which is normal and which is abnormal, and then combine it in a causal discovery process. What is the root cause and what is the consequence out of that?
Now the machine leaves the factory.
And you can already use it, let's say, in this FAT process, so the factory acceptance test. So before the machine leaves Zawanski, you can already use it by the expert users, this tool called Shannon and Darwin. So basically the setters who set up the machine can already benefit by getting insights. How does the machine behave? Does it look normal? Where's my bottleneck? Can I already start debottlenecking it? And this exact same task basically continue when the machine arrives at the let's say final destination in the production and is being set up, and you want to start production. There will be again with real material, so you will use let's say the material, for example, the input materials which are then used at this specific customer site. So they will behave a little bit different. The climate in the hall is different. So different humidity, different temperatures again. So the whole process, even if you have trained everything perfectly, will still again behave a little bit different than before.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the product, and do you sell now a model, a pre-trained model, and this model is learning? Or can you go a little bit more in details?
So we are an AI company selling software as a service. So we basically deliver a whole ready-made pipeline, which is trained on specific use cases, so a whole tool set.
And what machine learning techniques are you using now in this pipeline?
So it's a mixture of everything, to make it short, because there's not one model doing serving all the jobs. So basically, there's a whole pipeline full of
different... But it sounds very complicated, right?
Yeah, I mean, we did 150 years on research on it, and at the end, it came out something that worked, so it was rather an iterative process.
Okay. Share a bit, what kind of techniques are you using?
Yeah, it's starting with like unsupervised learning for learning behavior state models, then it's basically classifying states and using observation functions to find out, is this what we are currently observing normal, unnormal, good, bad? Or rather on a health score, on a continuous scale, is it getting better or worse, let's say? And then for sure, in the later stage in the pipeline, you also have some optimization models that are optimizing then the process, answering the question, what do I need to change from a parameter perspective to come to a better result in terms of product quality? And which parameter change would lead to a, let's say, worse result? So this is basically then an optimization model on top of these learned behavior models.
Where does the software run, or your application?
We have a classical hybrid infrastructure. So we're a pure software company, but we deliver a software container that runs inside the machine network. So where the controllers are, basically, that is collecting in high frequency.
So next to the PLC?
Yeah, the PLCs, RCs, NCs. So all these different controller types in the line. And we are one additional member to this network with a software container that is collecting on a proprietary protocol level from each controller all the high-frequency data, pre-processing it and streaming it, then pre-processed and encrypted to the cloud backend. So we have basically low latency in this local network. And then in the cloud backend that we are usually hosting on Microsoft Azure is basically the algorithms happening. So there we use the data stream coming in to processes and create actions out of it or recommendations out of it, where we have scalable computation power to process all this data in real time, because the value add only is created if you have a in-time feedback. So it doesn't matter if I tell you 2 hours later that there went something wrong. I think you figured it out by yourself. So it's basically the value add is only if I tell you right now, or let's say 2-3 seconds later, what was the root cause and what to do against it to get it rid of it.
Let's come back to the process. Now the machine is there. There's the ramp-up phase. You start the first run. What happens then?
The machine runs, and as Timo already phrased a bit, the setters, who are, let's say, the experienced people coming in from the machine builder, from Sauransky, they are still optimizing and tweaking the process here and there while the ramp-up is ongoing. But at the same time, you already have simultaneously ongoing training sessions. So with the operation folks, which are later on running the production line by themselves. So it's basically already a handshake, which is ongoing between the experts that are handing over the line to the operation staff. And in this handover process, basically, you must imagine you're handing over a huge production line, and there's a lot of stuff you need to explain, you should explain, a lot of different situations that can occur. And basically, in this trainings, our tools are used, especially Shannon, to give situational recommendations in terms of manual actions. So what to do now in this specific situation and in the language that you're currently able to speak, or you're locked in, basically, to support this handover process and to make it smoother and, let's say, more sustainable due to the fact that everybody can get recommendations at any time. So you don't have to remember all these 1,000 facts. You will get them insights, those insights in the situation when you need them.
Okay. Great. You mentioned data. What data are you learning from? You mentioned live data, right? How do you do that, Felix?
So we are not magicians, so we need the correct data. Otherwise, it's the old data science proverb, shit in, shit out. So that, therefore, we have different data sources that we are basically combining. One is, as I already mentioned, all these different controller data in a representative high resolution. But there are more data sources, basically. We have the context data sources, so to basically understand what is this machine doing, what else is it called, what process steps are existing, how are they called in a clear text that humans can understand them. And all this information is basically coming from machine controller projects, so these PLC files that machine programmers are programming. So they are very important inputs for us. And then in most cases, we also have context data, we call it. So that's basically describing the environmental facts around the machine. So temperature, humidity of the environment, because the machine will behave different if you put it in the tropical area or in the northern Germany. And then we also have information via live getting in for the raw material characterization, because especially when you process hygroscopic plastics, it will attract the humidity from the surrounding. And so you need basically an information, what kind of raw material, in which quality grade, and how old is it, and so on, is now being processed. And those raw material certificates we're also taking as inputs.
Mm-hmm. Aren't your customers nervous about data, Timo?
We have that discussion, but I think due to the solutions, I think that works fine. And it's also, we are using models in-house. So as Felix already mentioned, as we maintain the complexity, we are going to start using a module called Darwin, where we are analyzing the step change of our complex lines, understanding some timeouts or where bottlenecks may arise. And due on the digital twin, we can really visualize to us and to our customers. It helps for a very nice dialogue with our customers. Everyone is more movie oriented today, and having a Darwin on top, that helps to understand the step change better. And also we discussed about IQs and FATs, and even during the IQs, especially in the medical, we need to simulate the stops and failures which can arise. And this will give a data, or let's say a basic data, to create correction plans and corrective actions for the operator. So once our lines are delivered, they get, let's say, a basic knowledge database together with Shannon, and the customer can even then add new cases And so the system is learning and at the end proposing only the most appropriate corrective action.
There's one keyword you mentioned, the system is learning. Felix, you work in a highly regulated field. How do you manage to integrate learning systems there?
It's a good question, yeah. It's pretty complicated. I try to get it in a, let's say, less complicated way.
10 more minutes.
You have to differentiate which kind of learning we're talking about. What medical people and pharmaceutical companies are used to is having an AI system, a deep learning neural network that you train on a data set, and then you do a design freeze. So you basically just freeze the training data set, and you have a trained model that you freeze, and then you just use this model. So you just deploy it, basically, but it doesn't keep on learning. So it's fixed. And that's pretty normal. Pharmaceutical, as I said, companies do it since years already or decades even. But what we are doing is incremental learning. So you have to validate that the system itself, the method, how it keeps on learning is, let's say, safe or somehow controllable, rather to say. And that's a total different mind shift. And therefore, we basically use different approaches to explain what's going on. So there's, first of all, the technical explainability. So stepping into this explainable AI topic.
Oh, okay.
To get the measures to evaluate and assess how the system behaves and if that is safe or unpredictable. But at the same time, you also need to look at the observation of the model. So can we systematically parallel run evaluation models that evaluate always the next update of the model in terms of, is it still controllable? Is it what we expect? Or is it some unexpected behavior? And therefore, basically work also as a member of this ISPE working group. So it's a worldwide community for industrial engineers in the pharmaceutical world to think about how can basically those guidelines and standards look like, because yeah, everybody is collecting now experiences with it, but nobody has the final, let's say, clue.
Is that a USP of your solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the reason why we are at the moment worldwide unique with our tools in the GMP regulated area.
And you have the certification, right? So there's no problems with that, right?
To be precise, we are not certified because you can only be certified together with a machine. So you have a use case, a machine, and together with our software, you can get basically validated. Yeah, but that's, we can basically make proof that we are compliant to all the rules, and then as we are compliant as a part of the whole system can be compliant.
But why are only you capable to do that? With your team, are you so smart guys? Or why are only you capable to do that?
I would say it's a pretty special problem that we are solving continuously. And from the beginning on in 2014, when we started at Fraunhofer to researchers, was more or less a coincidence that some pharmaceutical companies were our very first interested partners at Fraunhofer. So that basically by accident came up all these requirements that were, that we must be explainable from the very first day on. So all the AI stack that we are developing must fit to all these requirements that we never thought about before as scientists, but they came just in from day one on. And therefore, we basically, in the upcoming years, we always designed algorithms and systems and tool chains that are fitting to those requirements. So basically, it is just an input that came in our roadmap from the very first day on.
Okay. Timo, now we talk a lot about technical stuff and about the software, and everything was great. Now we want to talk about results. What did the project bring you and bring your customer?
Yes, indeed. There are quite a few benefits, especially, let's say, for both for us and for the customer. So for us, as I said in the beginning, in the engineering time, while having a based on a digital twin, working with Darwin helps us to understand the step change issues in the right time. Imagine if you would have the line built and you have some kind of assembly operation which is running out of time and it's not capable to assemble or screw or check in the right time, or even you don't find the time out, and all your engineers are busy to find the solution. And here the AI Darwin module helps a lot.
So reduce engineering time and costs.
It will reduce engineering time, yes. And if there are failures, it reduces, first of all, failure cost and also time searching for a failure. and even avoid such kind of uncomfortable situations because at the end the time is always short and the time to market pressure is quite high. And for sure we would like to, or we have to deliver in time, and also complex line need to be finished. And looking for Shannon then working and offering to our customers a module with a basic know-how that helps even the customer for a faster ramp up and also at his factory. Yeah.
Faster ramp up means 20%, 30% faster, or?
At the end, I think in as an average, we have about 20% faster ramp up times. Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot. What else, Timo?
Yeah, I think that's on one side a lot. And also, I think remembering for the operator itself, you know, he's then maybe busy on work days during the night shifts or even on the weekend. And then he has to solve, okay, my line has stopped. Now I need to get it back into production. What can be done or what have I to do? So, yeah, he gets a call on his mobile device and then he can run to the line and get corrective action proposed based on also pictures and really step by step. For sure, if there is something to be done on the electrical cabinet, he needs to have the qualification. But at the end, he works very focused based on the cases we have given, and additionally, the customer can create his own cases. So at the end, the system is proposing the most valuable one, so it's learning step by step, and then he can solve and get the line back to production in a relatively short time.
Mm-hmm. What do you want to do with AI in the future, Timo? Give us a brief outlook.
Yeah, we would even like to use all the three modules, in which is Plus 10 offering, also the Hopper module, which comes then to the parameter level, where the, as Felix already explained, that the AI is listening to the molding cell, but also to the automation and its quality control stations, such as measurements or camera controls or camera measurements, and working with all these signals and data, IOs, and then giving a proposal to the operator, let's say, assuming the viscosity of the polymer is going to change a little bit on a batch change. Yeah. So that means within the validated process window, the AI is proposing the right parameter changes, or even maybe in the future, it's even possible to have a complete independency. And so we still work together with Felix and the team on such kind of cases to offer even more in the future.
Felix, what is on your research, on your product agenda?
Well, there's a bunch of features, let's say.
The most impressive.
Impressive for who?
for the customers, for sure.
Always a difficult question, because the target group, let's say the people who are at the end of the day on a daily basis use our tools, it's not one uniform, let's say, persona. It's automation engineers who have different needs. And for those guys, we are basically, our girls and guys, we are developing more insightful features so that we interpret the step chains. Let's say it's very technical, deep tech focus. And for operators, we have a focus on rather generating more understandable, say, procedures. So in the situation where there is a problem, we try to formulate it in a sense that everybody can understand it easier, let's say, and also vice versa. When they want to record something they did, so they want to describe how they solved the problem and give it as feedback to the software, that we help them by dismantling the input, what you're just speaking in a step-by-step approach, so that basically people can easier communicate with the whole software. So that's, let's say, more user-friendly at the end of the day. That's one side. And then from the model point of view, for sure, it's always for us one big research topic that I guess will never end. is getting from unstructured data sources structured data and therefore, let's say, usable data. So, for example, getting knowledge out of PDF documents that you as a human watching or looking at, and you see directly a structure, where's a table, what does this line mean, which is drawn from left to right, and so on. And to get this automatically extracted from documents, any kind of technical documents, it's pretty hard. And we are working on that to extract more information in an automatic way.
Perfect. Thanks, guys. Thank you, Timo. It was a pleasure. Thank you, Felix. It was a pleasure. We wish you all the best. And hopefully we will record an episode maybe in 1 year again and then talk about your new fantastic feature. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Robert.
You're welcome.